Explain gardening for the Gulf Coast with Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
All right, welcome back. It is a Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. There's a cold spell coming up, and it's raises questions. And I, you know, it's normal that it raises questions. I haven't wanted to stir up a lot of panic here, which you can do by talking about cold, because we don't get much cold anymore. We used to get cold a good bit, but it ain't what it used to be. So when cold happens, it's scarier than usual. Carol raised the important question, when we have these long periods of warm temperatures, even a minor cold spell can do some damage. In this case, I think we're going to be okay. It is a minor cold spell that's coming to Mobile. For our own sakes, for the benefit of everything, it would probably be better if we had more colder weather than what we've had this winter. But this one's a minor one. It's okay. We'll take what we can get, and I think everything's going to be fine. Even things that we worry about. Figs, if I were in Tennessee, if I lived up in the middle of Tennessee, or if I lived in Fort Wayne, Indiana, which is where a lot of us live in our heads. If I were up in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and I had a fig, and I saw this, you bet I'd protect that fig. But down here on the Gulf Coast, I don't know of a single fig that's not going to survive just about any winter you could throw at it. And this is a mild one by any circumstance, and this is a mild cold spell. A lot of plants need cold to produce well. So this is one of those winters where peaches are going to have a hard time, because a lot of the peaches that we grow, particularly if we've gotten them from, what'd you call it, Greg? But Lowdown Depot, you know, Lowdown Depot Mart from the big box stores, those peaches are not well adapted to us. They only are going to fruit, generally, when they get excess cold, when they get a lot more cold than we would normally get. And in a winter like this one, they're not going to fruit at all because they're simply not getting enough cold. Plants have a way of registering the number of hours below 45 degrees. They actually have a little time clock. And if I think about it and study it, I can almost explain to you how it works, but I'm not going to try that this morning. But there's a little time clock, this 45-degree thing. Temperature is below 45 degrees, the plants register it, and they won't bloom or produce leaves correctly unless there's been a certain number of hours below 45 degrees. And the number of hours below 45 degrees has been scant this year. I know we had that little cold spell coming up that started everything, and it was kind of weird that it was in November, but that's the way it's been happening recently. We've been getting these just little cold spells, little bumps, maybe earlier than usual, later than usual, just bright in the blue in the middle of nowhere, and then surrounded by very warm temperatures. And we're not getting the chill hours we need for a lot of plants to bloom. That's true for a lot of bulbs as well, but certainly for peaches and apples and things from the northern temperate zone. And Greg, you're right. Figs really don't need any chill hours, but blueberries do. It's just they don't need many. And so they're always going to do pretty well for us, unless you buy a blueberry that is from the north. And if you buy a blueberry that people in New Jersey are growing, you're going to make a big mistake. You want a blueberry that's from the Gulf Coast. So Rabbit Eye blueberries, they're always going to get enough chill hours to bloom. And that's the way it is. They don't need a lot of winter chilling, but they'll get enough here And they can bloom a little bit early because of that. But they're pretty well adapted, and their blooms are pretty cold hardy. So I think they're going to survive this freeze without a lot of damage. We got to talking about figs, and somebody sent me a picture of a fig. It's a big fig, about the size of it, just about covers the palm of the person's hand. It looks really impressive, and if you took that fig and you looked at the bottom, take your fig and look at the bottom. I think this probably was not a recent picture. Maybe it was. But look at the bottom of that fig, and you will see that there is an eye, a hole in the bottom of the fig. And you will notice that that hole in the bottom of the fig is really big, really large. You could stick a pencil in it. Now, this is interesting because the fig is a flower. What you're seeing is a flower. I know that's weird. It's not truly a fruit and won't be a fruit unless it gets pollinated, and it won't get pollinated here. It's weird. That's right. Inverted plant, kind of a flower inside out, but inside of there are a bunch of little flowers. And the little hole is designed for wasp to crawl inside of that fig and pollinate all those little flowers. Now, I could gross you out really big time, and I enjoy doing that. You know how much I enjoy doing that. And I just want you to imagine the whole wasp episode and the fact that it's pollinating and laying its eggs inside the fig, and that those eggs hatch out, and that all the little babies poop around inside the fig and then crawl out. Well, that's what happens when a fig gets pollinated. It's so much fun to think about. But the fact of the matter is, figs never get pollinated in our climate because we don't have those wasps in our climate, and we have varieties of figs that are designed to, basically, we're just eating the flower. Now, I know that sounds crazy, but that's what it is. But the hole is still there, and on some very large figs, that hole is very big. And even though the wasp doesn't crawl inside that hole, everything else does. So we tend to discourage, in this climate, growing figs with big holes in the bottom, because every creature you can imagine is going to go inside that hole and make a mess and create rot. And this is one of those figs. It's called, I'm pretty sure that's magnolia, sometimes called Brunswick, I think is another name for it. But well, let's call it magnolia. It's a fig called magnolia. And some people have it. My dad wanted it because it's such a big fig, and he planted it. I think he finally got one and planted it. And, you know, it just does what those magnolia figs inevitably do. Half the figs, more than half the figs, three-quarters of the figs on the tree were rotten before you could pick them because everything crawls inside that hole. It just, they don't do well. The big figs, they don't have as much taste. But I think that's magnolia. Don't be impressed by size. The smaller figs are always better, Celeste and Brown Turkey, but I think that's magnolia, if that's okay, that we're looking at. All right. So what else have we got? We got, have I gotten to most of the questions? I think I have. It's useful to think about this cold. A lot of plants right now, as we started out the show, I want to talk about this a little more, if you can. A lot of plants right now are putting their foliage up. This is the middle of winter, I know, but this is a deliberate strategy they have for getting sunlight in the middle of winter. And a lot of bulbs are out there now. Look for them in your yard. You know, it's a very interesting thing. I have a house in Midtown. Had it for a long time. I've had a great time with this garden. It's been a good garden. But there are little red lilies. The spider lilies are coming up everywhere right now. And I'm going to have a great, beautiful view of spider lilies because I'm letting that foliage ripen right now in the garden. Call me if you have any questions about what that foliage looks like in your garden. 251-343-0106.
I left Tennessee very much alive. And I never would have got through the Arkansas mud if I hadn't been a-riding that Tennessee stud. I had some trouble with my sweetheart's paw, and one of her brothers was a bad outlaw. I sent her a letter by my Uncle Foot, then I rode away on the Tennessee stud. The Tennessee stud was long and lean, the color of the sun, and his eyes were green. He had the nerve and he had the blood, and there never was a horse like the Tennessee stud.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Hey, welcome back. It's the Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. I've been going. I have been looking at my soil lately, longingly. Here's the thing. It's funny. I spend a lot of time creating gardens, which is mostly about creating great soil. There are many places in my yard where I could not grow anything. I mean, it was just terrible. It was terrible. And what I did was I spent a lot of time thinking about how do I create good soil here. One of the problems we have, and we're going to talk a little bit about this. I'm going to talk about it more next week. Is creating the kind of soil that plants can grow in with plenty of oxygen because we get so much rainfall. I notice that in areas of my yard where I haven't really worked to improve the soil, I'm going to tell you how I did that. The ground is so squishy, and I'm thinking, you know, plants aren't even going to be able to – there are very few plants that are going to survive this kind of moisture. And one of the things that happens in many mobile yards is that the water table stays so high, and then it draws down in summer, and plants have no root system to deal with the drought, and so they all die out. It's incredible. It's ridiculous. So in many ways, you have to build the soil up, and you build it up with organic matter, and I've done that in numerous places, and the plants grow like crazy just with organic matter. Nothing, and this is important. You'll discover this as you become a better gardener. Nothing that could become good organic matter leaves my garden. It just doesn't. And that has made all the difference. So it's not just the leaves. When I rake up leaves, I keep those. Weeds, you know what? I make piles of leaves. And those leaves rot down very, very quickly. And they make incredible soil. And they raise the soil level. Each time I do that, they raise the soil level just a little bit. And so what that means is that there's a lot more topsoil for plants to grow in before they get down to that saturated water level, and they survive droughts much better. It's an amazing thing. You know, so I gave to previous to when I've had to move before. I gave instructions. So when I first moved to Mobile, I built this great garden. That was in 92. That was a long time ago when I moved back to Mobile. I'd been in Mobile as a kid, but I moved back to Mobile in 92. And I built a great little garden at one place in Midtown, and I had to sell the house and the garden. And I hated to leave that garden. Oh, I'd worked so hard. I had so many interesting things going, but I found a great gardener to take it over. And she's done a beautiful job. She's just, it's beautiful. And she's made that garden her garden. But, you know, I sort of left a little instruction manual with the garden that was sort of the basics of what I knew about creating soil. And it was the soil that I left her, and it was the knowledge of how to make that soil every year that I left her. And her garden has been great as a result of it. It's been really beautiful. In many ways, she did a better job than I could have done. She was real sensitive with the front yard. She did just a beautiful, beautiful job. Beautiful job, and it's been great. But I did leave that legacy of soil and the legacy of creating that soil. So I've got lots of gardens, and I've got a garden I'm going to have to give up. I'm going to have to give it up, and I'm going to create a little gardening manual that says, here's what you need to know to make this garden work for you in the future, so that the next gardener, has the privilege of understanding how to keep that going. Because creating a good garden and creating good garden soil is something that happens year after year after year. But it's easy. It's easy when you know what you're doing. So we're gonna start that little instruction manual next week. It's sort of my instruction manual. Here's how to keep this garden going. Here's how to keep your garden going. Here's how to keep my garden going. It'll be my gift to the next gardener who takes over the soil here, and I'll be ready to start another garden somewhere else. That's the way it works. That's the way it works. Taking my knowledge with me and starting over, learning new things everywhere you go. I think we're going to start that next week. We'll start talking about that, so be sure to listen in. It'll be fun to talk about. David said I'm listening to David because we get lots of good advice. David Hubble said he cut his melaton back 2 weeks ago, as I typically do during this time of year. Even though this freeze may not be too bad for anyone with melaton vines, I think it would damage the plant if it gets below 30 to 31 degrees. Even though I protected it in November, I think 2 to 3 nights of the cold might... it ends there because he ran out of zip whip space, and it cut him off. But so you know there are tropical plants we do want to think about. Now I don't know. I think the roots might survive well enough. But if Greg, I'm sorry. If David, do you think that protecting the vine is important? Just as important as protecting the roots. I would have just protected the roots, but that may be my mistake. So if you've got a melaton vine, and some of you do, and they're really, really great little vines, and most years we don't have frost as early as we did this year, but if you've got a melaton vine, you might want to know this. David, do you feel like that it is important to protect the vine through the winter as well as the roots? Because I would have just protected the roots. So, any rate, it's David's thoughts. He said 2-3 nights of cold might cause a little too much stress going forward to the heirloom varieties. Just my 2 cents. Oh, and go Tigers, of course. That ain't the Auburn Tigers, folks. That's the national champion Tigers. That David's talking about. So that's interesting. That's interesting. David thinks you should protect those plants. David, by protecting them, I'd like to know what you're doing. Just a little bit about how you're protecting it. I would have just let the vine go down to the roots. And then protected the roots just a little bit on these cold nights to hold in the ground heat there to keep the ground heat from around the roots from escaping. I think that's very important, maybe the most important thing to do. Here's this would be my strategy if I had something like a tropical plant that dies back to the roots in winter and I'm worried about the ground freezing, which I don't think it would do in this case, but if I were worried about that, what I would do is take a pile of leaves or even take bags of leaves and put it on top of that plant and then cover that. And that would hold in that ground heat. Holding in the ground heat is what you really want to do in this case. You don't want that ground heat to be released into the canopy of the plant because there is no canopy to the plant. You just want to keep those roots nice and warm. I like putting bags of leaves over the roots because that way you can remove them. You can remove those bags of leaves before too long. And you don't create too much moisture in the ground because too much moisture, excess moisture in the ground can rot plants too, particularly if they stay cold and wet. But bags of leaves, oftentimes they're releasing heat because what's going on in the bags, those bags are moist, the leaves are moist, they're heating up as they decompose. And then put a sheet over that. That can work too. But David, I'd be interested in your thoughts. Any rate, we'll come back. Greg thinks I ought to talk about the leaf bag trick for a little longer. We'll talk about it.
Sugar magnolia, blossoms blooming, heads all empty and I don't care.
Saw my baby down by the river,
knew she'd have to come up soon for care.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Rain, rain on my face. Hasn't stopped raining for
days. Hey, welcome back. It's the Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. I'm just looking looking at temperatures, and it looks like in Neely, which is about midtown, right around the interstate, it's going to be... It might get down to 29 or 30, which is not a bad temperature for us. I mean, that's a good winter temperature. I want to see some days around 29 and 30. I'd love to see some days around 25 degrees, honestly. It's better for everything in the garden in general. Let me talk to you about protection. And I'm not making a big deal out of this because I think you need this time around. You might need it for some of the most tender tropical plants. Maybe if you wanted to be absolutely sure your bananas were okay, I would do this. But this is a thought. So let's say you've got something like a bulb in the ground, like some of the most tender amaryllis. Most of the amaryllis are going to do just fine here without any problem. But say butterfly amaryllis or some of the really tender amaryllis that are bulbs in the ground, or you've got something like a melitone. And you want to protect those roots because it'll come back from the roots every year if it's protected. You want that soil to stay well-drained. You don't want it to stay wet during the winter because they're not going to survive wet soil in the winter. That's the biggest no-no with melitone is cold, wet soil. They just are not going to take that at all. But you know that the ground has lots of heat. You should know that the ground has lots of heat. Let me tell you just one thing before I go on. The ground has lots of heat stored. It's got tons of heat. It is the great storage vessel for the sunlight. Sun shines on the earth, but you've got to know that the earth responds by absorbing that sunlight in huge quantities. And it stores that heat there. If it didn't store that heat, the difference in night and day temperatures would just fluctuate. It'd be like we'd be on Mars. I mean, we'd go from heating up in the sun to you know, it'd be 120 degrees during the day. And then it would go down to, you know, below 30 at night because if the ground wasn't storing heat, the ground and the oceans store heat. You can use that effectively, particularly in our climate. By holding in that ground heat, hold in the ground heat. Now, here's the thing. If you have a tall plant like a citrus that's got a canopy, you don't want to hold the heat on the ground. You want that heat to come up into the canopy because that's where your tree is, and that's where you want to protect the leaves, right? So you want to cover the top of the plant. But if you have a plant that is just a bulb, you're just trying to protect the bulb below ground, and there's nothing above ground, and a melaton might apply in some cases. You just want to protect the root, just want to protect that part underground. You don't want to get too wet. Then you want to cover the ground itself, and that keeps that ground heat from escaping. And you want to do it, you don't want to do it all winter. You just want to do it for the time period. You want that ground to be able to absorb heat most of the time. You want it to be able to dry out. So here's what I recommend. Save a few bags of leaves. When you collect your bags of leaves, save a few of them. Throw some fertilizer in there. I don't care what kind. Throw some cottonseed meal in there. Throw 10-10-10, whatever you got. Just throw some fertilizer in there. Make sure the leaves are a little bit moist. They probably will be, but moisten them up just a little bit. Shake that bag around, just to roll it around, shake it around. Get the fertilizer distributed through it. That bag is going to heat up pretty well. It's going to heat up really nicely. It's a radiator. And so you can put that on the ground and put it holds in the ground heat. It's giving out its own heat. That's a really nice thing. And if you want to, put a blanket over that. And then when this cold spell leaves and we get back to warm temperatures, which we're going to do, pull the sheet off, pull those bags off. That's all you got to do. It's real simple. Boom. You fixed it. Everything is fixed. Does that make sense? Hey, David, I'm listening. What's up?
Hello. I'd like to plant a hydrangea on the north side of my house.
Yeah.
And I want blue. I'm sorry.
Yeah, good.
I want blue blooms. What variety and when to plant?
Now is a great time to plant. It'll be a fine time to plant. But you're gonna plant when you can find the right variety. And you know, I don't know. There are a lot of very good ones. Blue, the classic blue for Mobile has been what's being sold as Nikko Blue, N-I-K-K-O Blue. And it is a very good one. There are a lot of others that are also very good as well. I can tell you what won't work as well. There are some varieties that were developed for the northern market that are being sold by the big box stores because they want to sell the same plant to everybody. And these are the so-called reblooming varieties, some of the ever-blooming varieties. Well, they're not ever-blooming necessarily, but they don't necessarily do well here. They were developed to produce blooms when blooms get killed over winter, which never happens here. So they're not the best for us. So almost any blue variety will do, but don't be sucked in by the idea that you have to buy these newfangled ever blooming varieties. They're not any better than just good old Nikko Blue and some of the others that are sold here. The question is, where are you going to find them? I hope the Botanical Gardens has a plant sale in spring. I don't know. There's a big question. We've got some great people working out there. The city has still not offered to help out the Botanical Gardens, which is really struggling right now. So I don't know if there's going to be a plant sale in spring. If there is going to be a plant sale in spring, you'll get an incredible variety of blue hydrangeas. All of them could work really well for you. But now is a great time. If you can find a good blue hydrangea, plant it now.
Okay. I've always heard if you want to do some light pruning on a hydrangea, you do it February 1st. Is that correct?
No. Here's what I would do. Here's the thing. Never prune a hydrangea from the top. It's just that simple.
I meant to say crepe myrtle. I'm sorry.
A crepe myrtle. Okay. No, I would not do a crepe myrtle that way. I would prune a crepe myrtle in June. It's one of the best times to do it. If you're going to do light pruning, it's probably the best time. It's okay to do it this time of year. It probably won't hurt too much, but it's not. There's some cautions. But I would say June is the best time to prune your, to do light pruning on your crepe myrtle, which is really the only pruning you should ever do. The truth is, and I will tell you this about crepe myrtles, if I had to prune a crepe myrtle, I'd think, goodness gracious, why am I pruning this thing? Because they really don't need pruning. They don't do better with pruning. They don't bloom better. So make sure you have a good reason to prune before you prune.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
All right, David. Good to hear from you.
You too. Bye.
Well, we lost our other caller, but we'll see what maybe they can call back. So, David, I'm interested because has vine still alive? I cut them back and do exactly as you prescribe to protect the roots. Okay, we've often seen that the vines. I see what David's saying. So here's what David is saying. He's pretty well saying the same thing I have. One of the go ahead and cut, and David, if I'm wrong about this, you jump in. David is saying cut the vines back to the ground. That when the vines freeze, and this is a problem with some other plants as well, if the vines are left standing during this cold spell, the freezing of those vines can actually create problems that send rot down into the root, is sort of how I'm going to describe it, and you can get problems that way. So go ahead and cut your melaton back to the ground and then protect the roots. If at these temperatures, even probably the root's going to be okay, but it would be a good idea to cut the vine back. If you want to protect the roots, just put something on there that you can move off the roots pretty easily, because you don't want to hold in a lot of moisture around that melaton vine. Holding in moisture on a melaton vine is a no-no. It can cause real, real damage. You don't want to do that. The wetness combined with the cold is what kills a lot of plants. There's a lot of things out there that have done real well. The angel's trumpets. David's given me the thumbs up, which is a good thing. We see that with some salvias. Similar situation with some of the salvias. You just want to be a little bit careful about keeping the moisture levels high. My angel's trumpets, a lot of the salvias have done real well this winter. They're blooming still. I've got a dahlia, my Dahlia imperialis, which is the tree dahlia. It's an amazing thing. It is an amazing thing. Imagine a dahlia that gets to be 8 to 10 feet tall. And blooms, and it does. And sometimes it'll bloom all winter long. It didn't this winter because we had that little eruption in November, but it's an incredible thing, and it's still doing really well. But it does not like to have wet feet either, so I make sure that I don't cover it with too much mulch, because it can kill the plant. Chris in Saraland is asking me, what would be the best time of year to fertilize a satsuma? Well, Chris, it depends on what you fertilize it with. I always, because it's so simple and because you can't mess up too badly, I recommend cottonseed meal and maybe occasional fireplace ashes. If you're using cottonseed meal, let me just go there. You could just use cottonseed meal by itself. If you use cottonseed meal, you can put it on anytime you want, and it'll be fine. And I would put it on right now. And how much do you put on? Well, a couple of buckets. And how big's a bucket? Well, we're going to come back and talk about that. If you're using chemical fertilizers, if you're using an artificial fertilizer, it's a different story, and we'll talk about that. So I need to know what kind of fertilizer you intend to use. We're going to be back here in just a minute.
In that fair land to which I go, I'm going home to see my mother. I'm going home no more to roam. I'm just going over Jordan. I'm just going.
Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, welcome back. It's Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. So here's what I would do with if I were going to put out cottonseed meal, which is great. I would use that on my citrus. Chris, here we go. Listen to me just a second. You're using cottonseed meal. That's great. It's really easy. You don't have to worry about what time of year you put it out, but now is a fine time to put it out. Probably won't start getting active until the weather warms in March, and that's perfect. That's just what you want. That's just what you want to happen. You want to spread it out around the base underneath that tree. Now, if this is a mature tree, you want it to spread that cottonseed meal out so that it basically gets out to the edge of the canopy. You don't have to put it right next to the trunk. In fact, you don't want it right next to the trunk. Start out about a foot away from the trunk and just spread it evenly out to the edge of the canopy as far as the limbs extend. That's going to take at about the right level. If you've got a 40-pound bag of cottonseed meal, I think that's what they're coming in now. Let's say it's a 50-pound bag. You want about a fifth of that bag around the tree, okay? One-fifth of the bag should be sufficient to feed one tree, one large tree. Smaller trees could get by with less, but about a fifth of a bag. I think a quarter of a bag would be excessive, but there you go, about a fifth of a bag. Of cottonseed meal. The good thing about cottonseed meal is, as long as you don't dump the whole bag on the tree, you're not going to have any problems. If you dump the whole bag on the tree, the problem you're going to have is that it's going to get awful smelly. You don't want to do that. It just kind of sits there in a big pile and doesn't break down very well. But spread it out thinly underneath that canopy, about a fifth of a bag of a 40 or 50-pound bag per tree. How's that? Jim in Georgetown is asking me, will this cool snap hurt the loquat that has set fruit for the first time? No, Jim. Let me say this. You tell me if my prediction is wrong. Here's what I believe about loquats, and I think I'm right. I've tried to observe this. I can't find anybody to tell me exactly that this is true because nobody really has experimented with it, but what seems to me after watching this process for 25 years carefully, what I will say is the flowers of loquats are very sensitive to cold. The flowers are very sensitive to cold. They will, if you get a cold spell when those flowers are opening, sometimes you can do a lot of damage. The fruit, on the other hand, is amazingly hardy. Now, I don't say the fruit's going to survive below 20 degrees, but 30 degrees, it's going to laugh it off. So if you see any damage at 28 degrees or 29 or 30 degrees on those loquat fruit, Jim, you have to call me back and tell me that I'm wrong. But this is what I have observed, that the cold during January and February doesn't seem to affect loquat fruiting nearly as much as the cold in November. So there you go. And October and November. So I think we're going to be okay. Now, again, 20 degrees and below, that's a different story. But at this temperature, I don't think you're going to see any problems at all. But let me know if I'm wrong for any reason. Vanna I'm listening.
Yes, sir. The question about my gardenias, how can I keep the leaves not that nice, rich green all year round and not have every so often so many of them turning yellow and falling off? It should be an easy question for you.
Oh, it should be. Well, here's the thing.
Try the miracle and grow,
Well, they go deciduous. One of the things I do recommend with gardenias is don't put them in a prominent place because the leaves are always going to fall off and get yellow. They never really look good as evergreens. And, in fact, I just persuaded someone not to use gardenias as evergreens. The dwarf ones as a prominent evergreen. They're beautiful because of the fragrance. I just don't like them in a place that is front and center. And that way the leaves can kind of yellow, and that's okay. The dwarf gardenias, let me just go back and say the dwarf gardenias have a big problem. They are really hard to keep looking healthy in our climate. Larger gardenias, basically, they like an acid soil. They need some fertilizer, but in any case, there will always be some yellowing of leaves and some deciduousness. It just is inevitable. I don't think there's a way around that.
Okay.
But if you've got them, now here's another thing. If you've got them planted too close to the house, do you?
Well, the older one is the older type too, and it's the strongest, and it was already there.
And it's next to the house. And it's
been there 15 or 20 years.
Yeah. Sometimes gardenias planted next to the house can get very sensitive to the leaching from the concrete.
Right.
And that can be a problem. But if the one next to the house is doing better, then that's not the issue. I have a great gardenia, and it just sometimes it just goes deciduous. Right now it's going deciduous. And it does that. I don't know, I don't think there's anything wrong with it. It just does that. And it's not going to be completely deciduous, but it's going to lose a lot of leaves this time of year.
Okay.
And you thought I was going to fix it, and I didn't fix it. I'm trying. You still there, Vanna?
Yes.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, well, I just... I'll think about it. But you're seeing the yellowing just at this time of year?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Maybe. I've put cottonseed meal under it at times, and I've put some worm castings under it just to see if that would help. I don't know.
Yeah, and I think I think this time of year it's just going to happen. The tree is naturally going to want to lose leaves. It's probably losing leaves in preparation to put on new leaves.
I see.
And it's just you're just going to see a little bit of that. I think it sounds like your gardenias are pretty healthy. The only thing I can recommend is putting mulch. Make sure there's a mulch out a good distance around the plant. But I think your gardenias are healthy. I think they're doing a normal thing. Mine are losing leaves right now too.
I see.
And it's kind of a response to, I think spring may be coming on, and maybe I need to get rid of some of these old leaves because they're not very efficient anymore, and let me put on a big crop of new leaves.
Okay.
Well,
thank you. I won't worry about it then.
All right. Vanna, good to hear from you.
Thanks.
Hey, folks, we'll be back next week. Check us out.
If it keeps on rain, Levy's gonna